Saturday. It's August 2nd, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker in New York.
And I'm Michael Haney in New York City.
And we are two of your AirMail editors who are here to provide a break from the horrific news of the day. Hooray! But first, an update from around the world. In Gaza, food prices have skyrocketed, with 1 kilogram of sugar now averaging $106. That's compared with just 89 cents before the war. Meanwhile, Trump has been forcing all sorts of trade deals, including one with the European Union that has been widely disparaged by Europeans. Meanwhile, he referred to India and Russia as dead economies, which seems typically hyperbolic. And the rumor mill is abounding that Kamala Harris may be gearing up for another presidential campaign as she prepares to go on book tour this fall. In the arts, we have some good news for movie theaters. Even though Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey doesn't come out until next summer, some IMAX theaters are already selling tickets, and 95% of them are gone within the hour. We've got to love those organized movie lovers. As always, AirMail is the antidote to all of the news of the day, and we have a great episode and a marvelous issue for you to enjoy.
Yeah, and we've got a great show today. You know, first, Elena Claverino is going to join us from Italy with her report on how the country's so-called king of ravioli is in hot water thanks to his plans to build a Las Vegas-like spa in a beautiful area north of Lake Como. Then, summer is the season of summer romances, but on TV, it's always hookup season, in particular in the world of reality TV. But the question is, why are viewers so obsessed with dating shows? And Sarah Dightem will join us to share a few of her insights. And finally, 3 years ago, a group of first-time crooks managed to steal $40 million worth of gold bars from a warehouse at Toronto's airport, all without firing a single shot. The heist is considered one of the most audacious and lucrative ever. It's also one of the strangest, with the ringleader apparently wanting to steal the gold so he could finance a Bollywood movie for his wife. Our writer, Harold von Kursk, has the incredible yarn. So, Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Let's start with the latest news out of Italy. Our colleague, Elena Claverino, who's a senior editor here at AirMail, joins us to talk about the latest controversy on Lake Garda. Welcome, Elena.
Hi, good morning.
Elena, your great story in the issue this week has all of the makings of an AirMail masterpiece. A storied house on an Italian lake, an Arrivist family from a pasta empire. Take us inside the drama unfolding on Lake Garda.
There's this kind of historic estate on Lake Garda called Punta San Vigilio, which has been owned by the same family since it was built, basically, in the mid-1400s. And recently, there was an inheritance dispute, which kind of culminated in one portion of the estate being sold to the king of ravioli, Giovanni Rana. You might recognize his name. His ravioli are sold in supermarkets all around the U.S., and he's like this genial character with white hair and kind of looks like typical Italian chef character.
Elena, this guy's an absolute legend in my house. His prosciutto ravioli is my children's favorite thing on earth to eat. So yes, we know Giovanni Rana.
Yeah, I mean, it's to be honest, the products are very good. I buy them as well. But yeah, so he somehow, because, you know, these kinds of estates are very, very much protected, but under Italian law, and he somehow kind of managed to get permission to make some very significant structural changes to the place. And that's kind of raised a lot of controversy with locals and with the Guarienti family, which owns this other portion of the estate.
So what's the history of the estate exactly? I mean, how long has it been around? And take us inside it sort of visually.
The estate has been around since around 1450. And it was built by a Venetian, like an affluent Venetian man called Agostino Brenzoni. And his idea was to create a humanistic paradise, an Eden for artists, philosophers, and Renaissance thinkers. This was during the Republic of Venice. And the villa, it's gorgeous. It's a pale stone structure with a hip roof and a Renaissance garden on the lake, with its own private beach.
And has it been owned by the same family ever since? Like, how has this property been used?
Yeah, it's been owned by the same family ever since. In 1498, it became an inn with 13 rooms. And it's also attracted some very notable characters. Everybody's kind of stopped in, from Napoleon to Gabriele D'Annunzio to Churchill to King Charles. It was painted by John Singer Sargent in 1913. So it's kind of remained the same for over 500 years.
And how is it possible now that this historic monument is open to development?
Well, this is kind of the whole question, right? There's been some local controversy around how they were granted permits to begin all this construction. The Guarienti family has requested to see these permits and they weren't allowed to do so. The superintendent who's supposed to be kind of overseeing the project from a like historical preservation standpoint is also a local politician. And the Ranas acquired this property via a shell company, and the ownership is obfuscated. And obviously that also raises a lot of questions.
You know, what exactly does the Rana family want to do with this? Because, I mean, frankly, if I were them and had millions of dollars made of selling ravioli, I would just move into the place.
Yeah, so for now, they've said that they want to create 6 luxury suites. They've already opened a restaurant and a beach club. But what's kind of also raising questions is that they've excavated a huge kind of 4,000 square foot technical area in the basement with electrical appliances, tubes. And this kind of technical area is far larger than what's typical for a small restaurant and a beach club and 6 rooms. So there's rumors circulating that the Ranas are trying to turn the property into a resort.
So basically this, you know, as you report, Lake Garda is emerging kind of as an alternative, right, to Lake Como, given that Lake Como has had such a rash of openings of hotels and hospitality launches. So is there some concern that this is going to chip away at the sort of historic character of the lake? Or is this more of a personal battle being waged over this villa?
No, there's definitely concern because there's been kind of similar incidents in other towns bordering the lake. You know, it would definitely make sense. For now, it's kind of a very quiet scene there of, you know, cyclists, but it definitely has the potential, and it is as beautiful as Lake Como, and why not make it a haven for $1,000 hotel rooms and Aperol spritzes?
Well, Anna, that's what I think is, you know, as you note in your reporting, you know, this case, as you said, kind of highlights this broader pattern in the region, which is, and maybe even all of Italy, which is these developers come in and they get the land reclassified for quote unquote tourist use, which seems to be a very pretty gray zone, right? And you can bypass these restrictions. And all of a sudden you're getting Garda, which is sort of becoming the Disneyfication of Como in a way, right?
Yes, exactly. And it's definitely something that extends through the whole of Italy. As our economy stagnates, the European economy stagnates and demand from overseas rises, it's very tempting to turn our country into a theme park. Unfortunately, it's happening in different areas of the country.
Elena, while we have you here, let's talk about that a little bit, because we have read so much about sort of the evolving nature of the tourism landscape in Italy with in the post-COVID years, there was this huge influx of Americans. Hotel prices, you know, were stretching over 2 and 3,000 euros a night in some cases. But we heard there was a bit of a slowdown happening this summer, you know, as a result of all of these tariffs and the new legislation by Trump and a sort of general cooling of this desire to travel. But what are you seeing in Italy?
I mean, it's definitely very, very, still very busy over here. And more than anything else, I would say for as a local, let's say, a lot of these destinations are no longer accessible to Italians. The price point has just really changed post-COVID. Things are not really affordable for European tourists anymore.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, that's what, you know, we've seen this backlash in European cities, Barcelona, Venice, you know, against tourists, wanting to put a tourist tax on people. And you're right, you know, and yet tourism is at least one of the top 3 generators of revenue in all of Italy. So it's an incredible tension, I would imagine. Like, you want to keep those people coming, but, you know, you also want to still feel like Italy is for Italians too.
Yeah, and you want to preserve a local sense of identity. A lot of people kind of struggle with this. My Venetian friends come to mind. The tourism drives them insane. And it's not necessarily tourists who are spending a lot of money and going to eat at restaurants. It's maybe people arriving for the day and having a sandwich, leaving the scraps of paper on the floor and leaving again. It's definitely an issue. But then, you know, in the case of Venice, they're not necessarily bringing a lot of money, but in many cases they are. So it's definitely a love-hate relationship.
Well, Elena, thank you so much. It's a great story, although a sad development, but we know that if anyone has to take that hardship assignment to go monitor things on Lake Garda, it will be you, and we thank you for it.
Thank you guys so much.
This is all sounding a bit like a reality TV show, but on that note, we have a marvelous story in the issue from Sarah Didham about our obsession with real love, or as real as it gets on TV. Bachelor in Paradise, Love Island, Love on the Spectrum. The dating shows we cannot stop watching are our next topic of conversation. Sarah is a London-based journalist and the author of the book Toxic: Women, Fame, and the Tabloid 2000s, my kind of book. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah, as Michael and I were preparing for this segment, he gave me his quote of the day, which is, I think I've seen a couple of episodes of Bachelor in Paradise. Is that right, Michael?
No, I think it's straight up Bachelor and maybe a few of the Golden Bachelor ones. I'm not saying, you know, I'm in that demographic, but I was just sort of, that was a car crash I wanted to take a look at.
Okay,
so well, we're saying you're a very cultured man.
Yeah, we're basically going to let Michael sit this one out with a cup of coffee. Now, Sarah, like, you know, these shows have been around, as you report in your story, since the dawn of time with the dating game in the 1960s. But for some reason this summer, it feels like almost all of the programming on television, whether it's in the UK where you are or the US where we are, is all about the search for love. How do you explain it?
Yeah, they have definitely taken over the schedules, haven't they? So the big ones that sort of motivated writing this piece were Bachelor in Paradise, which has been really dominating things in the States. I'm in the UK, so we have got season 11 of Love Island, which has generated an absolute ton of coverage and news lines and discussion and debate. At the same time, you've got shows like Love on the Spectrum, which is more of an old style observational reality show than a contest, which got huge affection towards the contestants in that. It follows people who are on the sort of autistic neurodivergent spectrum as they go on dates. And it's incredibly heartwarming, touching stuff, in fact, unlike quite a lot of the other stuff that goes on in dating TV. Then you have formats like Married at First Sight, which exists in an almost uncountable number of international variants. I know among people who are real hardcore fans of dating shows, apparently Married at First Sight Australia is the one that you really want to watch because that's where the biggest dramas happen. And you've got Love is Blind, which is a Netflix format. So Married at First Sight literally marries people at first sight, which sounds extraordinary, but that's where we are with TV, and then sees how they get along as couples. Love is Blind is similarly about bringing people together by sort of taking out some of the conventions of dating. And so the idea is that contestants sit in pods, talk to each other, never see each other, and then they choose each other on the basis. So the idea is that it's purely about personality and how you click with someone. That's become an enormously popular format as well. I think that really took off during lockdown, in fact, when lots of people could, in fact, relate to the idea of only communicating through speech and not actually being in the physical presence of people. So all of these things are kind of going on at the same time. And like you say, I think it does suggest that there's something going on, right? There's something in the culture that explains the appetite for these shows. And I think you can look at it from two directions. You can look at it from the interests of the networks and the streaming platforms for whom dating TV is a godsend in many ways, especially on linear TV, which has been losing viewers consistently and is fighting a losing battle against sort of second streams. But dating TV is pretty resilient, actually. So, for example, in the UK, ITV, which was our second biggest broadcaster until I think this week it was overtaken by YouTube, which is like a big sign of where things are going. Love Island is one of the sort of tentpoles of its year. If it didn't have Love Island, ITV would be in a huge amount of trouble because it's recorded day by day. So people watch it day by day, including those desirable, tricksy Gen Z people who are so hard to get to sit down and watch TV. And then they talk about it all the time, and then their friends want to watch it as well. It's also cheaper than making drama, which is another reason it appeals to people. And it is also endlessly discussable because people love to talk about other people's sex lives and romantic lives. And that's a very universal human impulse. And dating TV shows capture that. And that's how I see it from the audience's side. That's the appeal for audiences. We love to gossip, but also people have a lot of romantic anxieties at the moment, actually. We do live in a time when there is a lot of concern about how do men and women even get on? Are they operating on the same plane? Do they speak the same language even? And dating shows are a way for people to kind of test out those anxieties by watching other people do it on TV.
I mean, Sarah, do you think that this is just a reflection of the anxiety we're all feeling about the hard news, so to speak, you know, the state of the world, the burning of the environment, the environmental disasters that seem to be cropping up with every new news alert?
it's escapist for sure. I mean, I think if you need some kind of relief from thinking about apocalyptic things like famine, the demise of democracy, and, you know, the complete failure of environmental policy, tune in and watch a selection of very attractive people in swimwear try and hook up with each other. That is absolutely the sort of ultimate in terms of escapism. And it's always been about escapism. So Mike Fleiss, who is the creator of The Bachelor, which is, I think, probably the sort of the OG in terms of reality style dating shows in the modern crop. He called it a beautiful show about beautiful people living a beautiful life and hopefully finding a beautiful love. So always, always, it's been about that escapism.
Sarah, one of the things you talk about, I mean, obviously there's escapism, but you know what TV thrives on is conflict. Tell us about the show, which got, as you said, has a pretty eye-popping premise, X on the Beach.
Oh, my word.
I mean, because, for all your talk about love and na-na-na-na, I mean, this one sounds pretty, what do you say? It's like dumping a box of fireworks on a bonfire when you watch this?
It's extraordinary. So it's one of those shows that emerged in the wake of Love Island's success. And they cast a number of, typical hot young people looking for relationships, looking for romance, give them the impression that they are going to, a beautiful island where they're going to have a fabulous time and take part in this dating show. What those contestants don't know is that there is a whole other section of the cast which consists entirely of their exes. And these exes are then brought in as the show progresses. And as you can imagine, this causes maximum drama. And, that is the object. As you say, drama is what keeps people watching. But all dating shows are ultimately manipulated by producers to create as much drama as they can possibly generate out of a scenario. So the Love Island format, for example, has contestants who are tagged as bombshells. So after the initial cast have come in, started to establish relationships, begun to, as it's called in the show, couple up, you then introduce bombshells, and the idea is that the bombshells come in and they have the potential to break up these couples, to cause new drama and to create new storylines for the audiences.
So one of the things you talk about, which is you use a phrase I hadn't heard of it to sort of explain why these programs have such a strong appeal, is heteropessimism. Which is where you say we're straight men and women who are so appalled by the real life dating game that many speak openly of giving up altogether. But these programs are their last gasp at romance in a way, right?
I think you can definitely see them that way. Heteropessimism is one label that's been put on it. You've also got things like in South Korea, the 4B news movement, which is a really profound political act of rejecting men by young women. It's a minority movement, but it is indicative in South Korea of a very severe divergence of the sexes, which goes hand in hand with a real cratering birth rate, which, most countries, in fact, have a similar issue of people not forming relationships and therefore not starting families. That's pretty much endemic across the developed world as things currently stand. You also see things like, for example, incel communities of young men, which are, as sinister as the word incel sounds, a great deal of the discussion on incel forums is basically men saying, I don't understand women, I don't know how to make them like me, and I don't know how to become the kind of man that women would like. Similarly, you have women who are equally confounded and baffled by the men they meet when they try dating, by the fact that men seem to have completely untenable expectations of what women are like and what they'll do.
So you're saying these shows, these shows are then supposed to inspire them?
I don't know whether they inspire them necessarily, but I think they are a kind of forum where all of those anxieties can be kind of played out. So many people come into these shows and, the kind of reality format, there will always be a little introductory piece where people say, they'll do their I want bit, right? They'll explain why they have come on the show and what their you know, what their hopes are. And so often what you'll hear when people come on is they'll say, I'm sick of the apps, or I'm sick of the hookup scene. Especially you'll hear this one on Love is Blind. I'm sick of being judged on my appearance, although they're all very good looking people, but you know, whatever. But people who are coming in disillusioned by their experience of dating and relationships and romance. And obviously a part of that is amped up for the purposes of on-screen drama. But I don't think all of it is. I think people are motivated to take part in these shows by actually a desire to find love, as well as a desire to find fame, which you can never take out of the picture.
Sarah, the one that strikes me as the craziest is Naked Attraction, which I didn't believe was actually a thing until I saw it in the UK, and then I couldn't stop watching it. I mean, Michael, you haven't seen this, which is probably why you sleep at night, but it reveals the contestants' entire bodies, starting with their feet. Like, there's a screen in front of them, and over the course of the show, potential dates will ask them questions, and then the screen is lifted up and up and up and up and up, and their face is the last thing you see. You see the entire body beforehand. I mean, Sarah, how is this even allowed to be on television?
I mean, you can say that about a lot of things, really, can't you? But it is quite the shocking format. And I, too, struggle to believe in its existence when I'm not actually looking at it on a screen. And it, obviously, that is a very titillating format. But if you wanted to make the kind of highbrow argument for it and for what it's trying to do, it is like so many of these shows. It's about trying to strip something away, literally strip something away in this case, and get to a sort of an essence of attraction or romance. You know, what would it mean if you didn't have someone's clothes to judge them by, right? If you couldn't, you know, decide, oh, that's the kind of person I really like because, in my case, he's wearing a BAM t-shirt and, you know, he looks like he might play rugby. And that's the kind of person I never go near because he looks like he works in a bank and that's awful, right? You take those signifiers out of the picture and you're just dealing with, what am I attracted to? And that is actually quite an interesting question. What do we judge people on? What is our attraction based on?
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for this very provocative discussion. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Sarah, it's a terrific piece. Thank you so much.
Well, our next story takes us all the way to Toronto. And who knew it was so easy to steal so much money? Our writer, Harald von Kerskt, who is a Stockholm-based journalist and screenwriter, joins us to tell us all about the story that we think should be the next bank heist movie starring George Clooney and Brad Pitt, obviously. Welcome, Harald.
I'm glad to be part of this podcast.
So, Harald, this heist in Toronto, which many consider one of the top five most successful ever, where the criminals, without firing a shot, scored almost $50 million in gold that had arrived on an Air Canada flight from Europe. Tell us the backstory here, because it's astounding.
A Great Pearson Airport gold heist, which I think is one of the most spectacular and effortless robberies in history. No violence, took less than half hour to pull off from the time the rather clueless driver showed up at the Air Canada cargo terminal loading bay. And within 27 minutes, the forklift driver, who apparently is not involved in the robbery, had loaded the crate into the back of his 5-ton truck. And at precisely 7:30 p.m., Durante King McLean, a low-level criminal age 25, had pulled away, and a half hour later, he had disappeared for good. And the gold was gone, baby, gone, to reinforce the Hollywood movie reference that the Peel Regional Police Chief made when he described it as a sensational robbery worthy of a Netflix series.
It was surprising to me how unguarded these gold bars really were. I mean, this is an awful lot of money, but I think your story gets it, the way that these incredibly expensive goods are traded and shuffled between nations, right? Tell us a little bit about who was looking after these gold bars and why were they flying commercial?
That's an interesting question. Brinks was hired by Valcambi, which is one of Europe's largest precious metals refiners. And they had been... And the Toronto Dominion Bank in Canada, which is referred to, I think, as the TD Bank in the U.S., had ordered 6,600 gold bars, 99.9% pure, which is the international standard, for delivery to Pearson Airport, which is just, it's the airport, Toronto Airport, you know, 20 miles outside the center of Toronto. And Brinks was responsible for providing the security, but they didn't assign any guards to a shipment, which in today's prices for gold would be worth $45 million as part of a pallet crate that was loaded on board a commercial Air Canada flight, Zurich, bound for Toronto. And when it arrived, there was no special security arrangements. It was taken directly to the Air Canada cargo terminal. And obviously, the criminals had advanced knowledge of this shipment, and they planned it to the minute. As soon as the crate or pallet, if you want to call it, was placed into the Air Canada storage terminal, one of the inside men as part of the job, a man by name of Preet Panesar, alerted Arsalan Sunny Chowdhury, who was the mastermind of the operation. He was staying at a hotel a few miles away from the airport. And then Sunny Chowdhury gave the order to the getaway truck driver, Durante King McLean, age 25, to head for the cargo terminal. And he pulled up at the terminal, showed a waybill which had been forged from a previous day's shipment of Scottish salmon. And within 27 minutes, he was gone. And a half hour later, so was the gold, because the police were only able to track the truck until it left a highway and disappeared somewhere west of the airport. But there were no specific security arrangements taken either by Brinks, and they didn't request Air Canada to take any security arrangements. And subsequent to the robbery, Brinks sued Air Canada because they said they had alerted Air Canada to the fact that it's gold, 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 gold they put on a document. Unfortunately, and this is another part of the comic element to this great Canadian caper, they didn't fill in the declared value for customs box in the standard document that perhaps you and I fill when we're going to certain countries. I don't know if it's used anymore, but certainly for cargo shipments, you have to fill in the box. What is the declared value of the shipment? They left this blank. And 5 months after Brinks brought a lawsuit for approximately $20 million US against Air Canada, a Canadian judge ruled in favor of Air Canada, citing the fact that Brinks didn't fill in the box. And according to international aviation conventions, Air Canada is only liable for the maximum amount, approximately $17,000. But for me, the most fascinating aspect, or the most Hollywood aspect of the story, is that the co-planner of the operation, Preet Panesar, he apparently was motivated by the desire to finance a Bollywood film for his wife, a former Miss India Uganda, meaning a person of Indian ancestry who was living in Uganda and then won a beauty pageant either in Uganda or in India. And she was an aspiring Bollywood actress. And in 2022, 1 year before the robbery, Panesar, her husband, and her name is actually Preeti Panesar, and his name is Preet, but anyway, that's another funny story. Her husband had tried to finance a movie for her, but the project never came off. So from everything I know, and with speaking to members of the Indo-Canadian community in Brampton, it looks like Panesar wanted to pull down a big score to finance the Bollywood career of his wife.
So, as you also note in your story, he has fled to India, and Canadian authorities know where he is and that he's there, yet India will not extradite him. Is that correct?
Because India has had terribly fractious relations with Canada and the Trudeau government over the arrest of two Indian government presumed assassins who killed a major Sikh leader in Vancouver, there is no possibility of any extradition of Mr. Panesar to Canada.
It's a riveting case, as you say, cinematic, Hollywood, Bollywood.
But they were amateurs. I mean, apart from pro forma denunciations of crime in general, there's ample room for us to admire how a group of ordinary law-abiding Indo-Canadians and one Pakistani, who is Chowdhury, staged the heist, as you said, without need for violence and executed it within 27 minutes. And of course, we could try to dismiss the heist as some one-off transient anomaly, to use an odd expression. We can allow ourselves a moment to admire the audacity of it all. And anyone who has followed crime stories such as Money Heist or other similar Netflix or Amazon Prime series has to appreciate the elegance of this robber, because these were not criminal masterminds. They had no experience doing any of this, but they came up with a good idea and they succeeded in pulling it off.
Well, Harold, thank you so much for sharing your story and for being on the show today.
Thanks very much.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene. AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report, our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it, is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Okay, Michael, if you find that gold, don't tell anybody except for me.
You know, I'll just sort of like send you in a sort of cryptic text telling you where to meet us and we'll go from there.
You know what we should do is just like buy a fabulous historic home on Lake Garda.
Why not?
All problems will be solved. All right. Well, it is the weekend. Get us out into the universe of culture. Give us your recommendation.
Well, I got one and I stumbled upon this. It's a show that is currently on Amazon Prime, a limited series. It stars one of, I don't know, the guy everyone's kind of crazy about, Jacob Elordi. It's a limited series called The Narrow Road to the Deep North. Have you heard about it?
I have not.
See, no one's heard about it. I hadn't heard about it. Someone mentioned to me. It came out like a year ago in Australia. It's an Australian production. It's now come to the UK and US on Amazon Prime. Anyway, it's amazing. It's an adaptation of a Booker Prize winning novel, and it sort of takes in three timelines, and it's basically a group of Australian prisoners of war constructing the Burma Railway in the mid-1940s. Jacob Elordi plays this Australian soldier who's caught by the Japanese, sent to this camp to build this. And then he's sort of cut up to the future, late 1980s. He's an older man and he's kind of looking back. It's a beautiful love story, a war story. And I think it's incredible performances and just immensely powerful as well. And it can be brutal as well as the camp stuff. It's a sort of very heavier version of Bridge on the River Kwai kind of stuff. But it's terrific. Elordi is great. It's a way you've never seen him before. And it's called The Narrow Road to the Deep North. And it's streaming now on Amazon Prime. And you, my dear?
Okay, Michael, I wish I could recommend the film Eddington, which is a new neo-Western black comedy, as it is described, written and directed by Ari Oster. I'm afraid I cannot. Okay, it stars Joaquin Phoenix, Pedro Pascal, Austin Butler, and Emma Stone, all incredible actors, all who do a marvelous job. But this movie did not do it for me, I'm sorry to say. So it's set in a small town in New Mexico during the COVID pandemic in 2020. And it concerns several players in a mayoral race, but it also gets at the, you know, many social issues that were rocking the United States at that particular moment. It came out a couple of weeks ago. I thought it was too long. It was 2.5 hours. Like, I just can't sit through a movie that long, I'm sorry to say. I made it through 1 hour and 45 minutes. It was a bit slow. As one of my friends who's a screenwriter in LA told me, you're not going to like it, but it's a very, very good movie. And okay, I'll take that. But I will say I just could not stomach the entire thing, although perhaps that's just a sign that I have some sort of low tolerance for thoughtful films. On a totally different note, I finally did a trip that I had been wanting to do forever. With my mom last weekend, we were up at a family reunion in the Midwest, and we went to Madison County, Iowa to see the Bridges of Madison County, which I know is like the dorkiest, 90th possible thing to do, but it was really amazing. We went to the little town of Winterset and drove around and saw some of the 7 covered bridges. It was just a really fun, unexpectedly delightful slice of Americana. And it caused me to re-listen to the audio version of the book, The Bridges of Madison County, and rewatch the movie. And they both hold up incredibly well. So if you find yourselves in Des Moines, Iowa, or its environs this summer, you'd be doing yourself a disservice if you did not drive over to Winterset. So enjoy The Bridges of Madison County in all of its forms. All right. Well, we thank you all so much for joining us. We wish you a wonderful weekend. Mike, will you please read us out? Thank you.
Morning Meeting is produced by AirPlay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our co-editors are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. And our deputy editors are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis. And our music supervisor is Randall Poster. The theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AirMail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AirMail Weekly, but we will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting. In the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music. But most of all, thanks again for joining us.